From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. Having just come back from the ACC meeting, we covered lots of very important trials. This week, I'm going to give you sort of a mini valve symposium. The next couple of issues of JACC have, I think, several important articles for the management of aortic valve disease that I thought I would share with you in podcast form. The first one looks at coronary angiography and PCI in patients who've had a TAVR. Obviously, we see TAVR used in elderly individuals with predominantly senile or calcific aortic valve disease, and not a small number of them actually have coronary artery disease. The first point, of course, is that patients who are undergoing TAVR should have a multidisciplinary heart team to evaluate their coronary artery disease at the time of their valve procedure. After TAVR, people can use multi-detector computed tomography to approach issues that may relate to the coronary arteries and the approach to coronary access in patients who may undergo elective procedures. The design of the core valve has a narrow waist, and therefore engagement of the left coronary artery in this setting typically requires a smaller catheter than usual. For left coronary engagement, the recommendation is a JL 3.5 for femoral access and a JL 3.0 for radial access. For the right coronary engagement, a JR4 is typically the catheter of choice. Sometimes selective engagement of the coronary aorta is a problem, and in that case, a coronary wire can be used to enter the coronary artery from the aorta, and then it can act as a rail for the guiding catheter. Care should be taken when disengaging the guide because it can kink during the procedure. So the guide should be disengaged from the ostium, preferably over a wire, before withdrawal through the diamond of the valve frame. Coronary angiography technique typically does not have to be modified much in the presence of a balloon expandable valve. If there is a problem with selective angiography, then the most likely cause is the position of the commissural tab, which is in front of the coronary ostia. In this scenario, often a person can place the catheter across the adjacent frame and then do non-selective angiography, which at least is usually diagnostic. The article that I'm reading from JACC, talks about the fact that in the future it would be useful if the commissural tabs were radio-identified. This would give a simple mechanism for kind of knowing where they are, much the way we currently have this type of information with patients who've had coronary bypass surgery, for example. Okay, so we're going to move from that article to a paper also in JACC describing reduced ejection fraction in patients with aortic stenosis and evaluating the prognostic aspects of that, as well as some of the temporal courses of patients with reduced LVEF in severe AS. These investigators evaluated echoes on over 900 consecutive patients with first-time diagnosis of severe AS, defined as a valve area less than 1 cm². And these individuals had had at least one echo before the diagnosis. The investigators then reviewed almost 3,700 echoes, about 3 per patient, within the preceding 10 years. And the primary endpoint was looking at all-cause mortality. At the time of diagnosis, 196, or 21%, of the patients had an LVEF less than 50%, average about 35%. And the rest, 79%, had an LVEF greater than 50%. It was interesting. LVEF deterioration had begun before aortic stenosis became severe for those patients with an LVEF less than 50%. And it looked like it accelerated after the valve area reached a level of 1.2 centimeters, whereas the LVEF mean remained greater than 60% in patients who had an EF greater than 50% at initial diagnosis. The strongest predictor of LVEF deterioration at 3 years before AS became severe was an LVEF under 60%. In other words, if the EF wasn't, in a sense, supernormal, it was a strong predictor of LVEF deterioration. During a median follow-up of 3 years, mortality was much worse, not only for those who had an EF less than 50%, but also those between 50 and 60%, whereas patients with LVEF greater than 60% did better. So this was interesting. It describes that there was a cohort of individuals whose EF appeared to be declining before their AS became severe, and it accelerated after the valvularity reached 1.2. It also notes that an LVEF less than 60%, even in the normal range, may actually be a group where we have to wonder. This reminds us, of course, for instance, with aortic valve and mitral valve regurgitation, where particularly with MR, a supernormal EF is normal, and anything under 60% is actually abnormal. It remains to be seen whether or not this particular analysis will lead to any further changes in our practice, but I think it certainly calls to mind a couple of things. One, is there a group of patients where the EF is deteriorating at valve areas that are not severe? And we have to wonder whether there's something going on here. Maybe these are individuals who just don't have the ability for their ventricles to handle the afterload, even of moderate severe AS. And the other is the optimal timing for replacing the valve in patients with severe AS actually could be a higher EF, even between 50 and 60, for example. So I thought it was an interesting article and worth reviewing. The third article actually is sort of a review of an old-time friend, the Ross procedure. This was a study of about 400 patients who underwent a Ross procedure between 1992 and 2016 and comparing them to 1,900 patients who had isolated mechanical aortic valve replacements during the same time frame, taken from both Australia and New Zealand databases. They included patients between the age of 18 and 65, and they did propensity score matching to assess for risk. And then a Kaplan-Meier method was used to analyze unadjusted survival. The Ross procedure patients, as you'd expect, they were younger, they had fewer cardiovascular risk factors. And in the analysis, the Ross procedure was associated with longer cardiopulmonary bypass, of course, because it's two-valve surgery, and a longer aortic cross clamp. The 30-day mortality was low, 0.3% for Ross, 0.8% for mechanical. The Ross procedure patients had superior unadjusted long-term survival at 20 years, 95% for the Ross versus 68% for mechanical. And multivariate analysis showed the Ross procedure was associated with the risk of late mortality, which was quite low. This is an interesting article that sort of re-raises the potential value of the Ross procedure. Critiques of the article are that because of the young nature of the Ross patients, there could be unintended biases there that made that cohort look better. I guess the other thing to argue is that when you put a mechanical valve in a patient, often the orifice area is smaller. And one wonders whether if they had compared this to patients getting an isolated tissue aortic valve replacement, if things might have looked better. I was impressed that the Ross patients, when young, did have apparently very good 20-year outcomes, and it certainly raises the issue of whether we should continue to consider the Ross procedure in some of our younger individuals. So let me close with a fourth article related to aortic valve that I thought was really quite excellent as well. This is also in JACC. And this is a multi-center registry which included nearly 300 patients who had low-flow, low-gradient aortic valve stenosis and reduced ejection fraction. And it's really looking at the potential value of TAVR in this group. So these patients had to have a mean gradient less than 35, a valve area less than 1.0 centimeters squared, and an ejection fraction less than 40% undergoing TAVR. For most of the patients, they had a dubumbian stress echo before the procedure looking for the presence of contractile reserve, which was defined as a greater than 20% increase in LV stroke volume. Transthoracic echo was repeated at discharge and at 1 year follow-up, and they reported outcomes at 1 and 12 months and then yearly afterward. The median STS risk score of the study population, 7.7%, mean EF, 30%, mean transvalvular gradient, 25%, respectively. The presence of LV contractile reserve during a dobutamine stress echo was seen in about half. The mortality rates were 3.8% at 30 days, 20% at 1 year, and 32% at 2 years. When they looked at the multivariable predictors of all-cause mortality, they were chronic obstructive lung disease and a lower pre-procedure hemoglobin level. When they looked at predictors of a composite endpoint of all-cause mortality and rehospitalization due to heart failure, the predictors included a low hemoglobin as well as moderate to severe aortic regurgitation after the TAVR. In looking at this group of patients, the LVEF on average increased by about 8% after TAVR, and that was a significant improvement, of course. Predictors of one-year outcome with improvement included a lack of prior coronary bypass graft surgery, also a lower EF at baseline predicted improvement, and a lower stroke volume index predicted improvement in EF. It's interesting, in this particular paper, the absence of contractile reserve on baseline stress echo was not associated with any negative effect on clinical outcomes or LVEF changes. So in summary, this article looking at TAVR for low-flow, low-gradient AS showed good periprocedural outcomes, reasonable survival, although one-third of patients are dead at 2 years. Pulmonary disease and anemia and residual perivalvular leak were associated with worse outcomes. And the dobutamine stress echo did not appear to predict clinical outcomes or EF changes over time in this population. Now, you may recall that the current guidelines and appropriate use criteria suggest that TAVR or surgical AVR is appropriate for patients who have low flow, low gradient AS and an EF of 20 to 49%, regardless of LV contractile reserve, but that it would be appropriate only in patients with a low EF, that is really low EF, less than 20%, if there's evidence of LV contractile reserve on a stress echo. The absence of LV contractile reserve on stress echo has been associated with poor prognosis after surgical aortic valve replacement. So it remains to be seen whether or not the data from this particular study will influence our practice guidelines. But I think it was an important article and certainly establishes, I think, the value of TAVR in this unique cohort of patients with severe aortic valve stenosis. So I've given you a mini symposium on aortic valve disorders and techniques today. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. You can find this information on the American College of Cardiology's website. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.